What's that dish? Hello and welcome back to the Food Safety Dish, a production brought to you by National Farmers Union's Local Food Safety Collaborative. I'm your host, Catherine Cavanaugh. Today, we're talking all about assessing your own agricultural water. It's true that you can't farm without water. It's also true that water can be the conduit of significant risk on farms. After all, water is life, and this includes all kinds of life. Unfortunately, this also includes some pathogens that also love water. If you haven't heard the news, there's a new water rule rollout from FSMA's Produce Safety Rule that has just come into effect this year, 2024. And with it, plenty of conversations and questions on what is and isn't relevant. One of our goals here at NFU's Local Food Safety Collaborative is to make information and resources more accessible to all farmers, including small farmers who are not covered or qualified exempt from the Produce Safety Rule. But just because you aren't covered or have exemptions doesn't mean your knowledge of good food safety practices has to slip. We got today's scoop from Michigan State University's Extension Educator and On-Farm Food Safety Statewide Coordinator, Phil Toko. Phil helps to bridge the gap of what seems like highly technical regulatory language and distills it into an accessible pool of knowledge that can help empower growers. Hear what he has to say about water hazards, risks, and how you can assess agricultural water risk on your own farm. Welcome to the Food Safety Dish, Phil. We're really delighted to have you here and learn all about your expertise. We'd love to have you introduce yourself and share a little bit about your background in food safety.
Sure. My name is Phil Toko. I work with Michigan State University Extension. I am based in Jackson County, but I cover the entire state with respect to on-farm produce safety. I work with produce growers, very large and very small, and everything in between. The water happened to be one of those things that I sort of fell into. I sort of fell into the well and ended up early on trying to decipher how to look at risk in water. And then when they put the water rule on hold for a while, I got deeper into it. So get drilled deeper and deeper into the well. So.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. And all water analogies are welcome if you feel like splashing into that.
Oh.
Okay. So I guess let's just start off very broadly. And the question is, how do you define risk on a small farm? And generally, what are the major risks associated with agricultural water?
Okay. So what's interesting to me is the differences between hazards and risks. And we're going to talk a little bit about the FDA water rule, and it's really a hazard-based model. It asks you to look at all of the different things that could potentially introduce risk. So that's a hazard, but when an actual risk is the probability that that stuff, that hazard, is going to get into the water source and foul it so that it actually makes people sick. So when I look at risks for people, we try really hard to separate the difference between a hazard and a risk, because there are lots of hazards that won't ever be risks. If you're growing with an 8-foot fence around your orchard, and some orchard, large orchards even have 8-foot fences around their orchards, you know, wildlife is not going to be a risk, but they are a present hazard in terms of around the field. So it's important to look at it that way. Does that help kind of define how I help growers identify risks?
I think so. So the hazard is like the potential, and then the risk is like the hazard that is activated. Is that right?
Is it a big deal, the possible versus the probable? If it's possible, mm-hmm. It's a hazard. If it's probable, it's a risk. Does that make sense?
Gotcha. Yeah.
So
Yeah, so with that mindset, what are, I guess, the general hazards associated with agricultural water, sure, and then moreover the risks that you find commonly with ag water on small farms?
Sure, small farms can be interesting because a lot of times, you know, farmers are used to looking at pest management, they're used to looking at nutrient availability for plants, but they're not necessarily, they don't always have a really good well-developed food safety lens or produce safety lens. And with water, it's all about the poop, finding ways that poop can travel. It's the routes of contamination and then the sources of contamination. So we've got sources. If there's a route that brings that poop in, you know, we look at the sources to start with. Do you have domesticated animals? Do you have a dog that likes to play in the pond? Those kinds of things. And then are you drawing that water up from the pond? And then how are you applying it? You know, really fundamentally, a grower can control a lot of different risks by changing the way different pieces of the puzzle with respect to water application. You know, there's really three areas that we concern ourselves with in the broad sense with respect to water risk. And first is the source. We've got high risk sources and low risk sources. High risk sources like surface waters, particularly those waters that move, that those are higher risk sources. And then as we move down, wells are sort of an intermediate risk. And then the lowest risk is treated municipal water. So thinking about it that way, that's not to say that there's not a potential for though each of those, even the safest water source, to be fouled. In a lot of cases, we've got situations where municipal water, and a recent case, for instance, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where there was water that was pumped specifically, it was municipal water pumped specifically for irrigating lawns, and it was recycled water. So basically, it was gray water, and kids were playing in it in a sprinkler, and they got themselves sick. So, you know, just because it's municipal water doesn't mean it's necessarily safe. The treatment is important and the monitoring of it to make sure. And that's what municipalities do. They monitor it and they treat it to make sure that it stays safe. That's what makes municipal water safe. In the absence of those things, mm-hmm, you have a much higher risk. So the source is one thing, and then the next is how it's applied. So you can, if you have a high risk source and you apply it in a manner that doesn't contact the harvestable portion of the crop, then you've got you've mitigated that risk. It's a way to get in front of a risk. So the application, obviously the safest is indirect application, like drip under plastic when you're dealing with something that isn't going to contact the harvestable portion of the crop. And if you're going to use a sprinkler and sprinkle all through the canopy of, say, a tomato plant, that would be a much higher risk application rate because it's there. And then the timing of the application is important. If it's right up close to harvest, that's going to be a high risk application. So we need to make sure that we use a low risk source and a low risk application right up close to harvest. A lot of times, a good example out west in the southwest, a lot of times what growers will do in leafy greens is they'll apply water overhead on leafy greens to crisp them up before they go through and harvest them so that they're nice and firm because they grow in the desert. So if we think about that, that's a super high risk. It's right before harvest, like 12 hours before harvest. So it's a high risk application. So that water really needs to be super duper clean in order to get us a good product. There's not a lot of margin for error on that application. However, a small grower that's planting tomato plants with a water wheel, that water can be super poopy and in the water wheel, and it can deposit, but because there's no flowers, because you're just transplanting tomato plants, it's never going to contact that harvestable portion of the crop. So the water quality is immaterial. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Are there any mindsets that growers can utilize to think more holistically about water on the farm that you recommend?
I always talk about, especially small growers, I want them to think about where the water contacts the harvestable portion of the crop and I want them to limit their liability. It's not only mitigating risk and reducing risk, but also reducing their exposure to the rule. So the more we can indirectly apply water, the more we can find ways of getting water to not touch food contact surface and harvestable portion of the crop, the better, the less exposure they're going to have to the rule, which means lower liability, but it also means that they're making the crop safer. That's the elegant part of the rule, is that if you're doing things to improve food safety to mitigate risk, you're also doing things, if you limit your liability, if you have to take fewer tests and have to do less to really, if you're really not letting that water contact the harvestable portion of the crop, then it's not regulated under the rule. You don't have to do as much for that water. That I may have gotten lost in a rabbit hole. Helpful. Sorry.
No, I think that's really interesting to not only think about what the water is touching, but also what the water is not interacting with. Right. And I think that's a good way to kind of round out how people can think about water on the farm.
Sure.
Hey, Phil, Billy McCarthy from NFU and a small grower myself here. I'm wondering what are some examples of tools that farmers can use to assess their hazards and then their risks. I could imagine, you know, visual inspection of equipment, doing water testing, but what are some things that you recommend and how growers go about taking a look and cataloging maybe some of their hazards and risk potentials?
So without being shamelessly plugging my own tools, that a group of us, MSU, Cornell, and University of Minnesota created, one of the tools that's out there is a risk prioritization tool, which we'll probably discuss a little more as we get into things. But also there's an ag water assessment builder that FDA put together. It tries to help growers think through where the poop comes from, how the poop gets to the produce, and really help the growers think about ways that they can essentially get in front of the poop or stop the poop from getting on the produce. So, and that's true of all tools. I mean, it comes down to wherever you're, whatever tool or whatever educational material you're working with, it really comes down to where's the poop, how's it getting there, and are there ways that you can get in between the poop and the produce so that it doesn't get on the produce?
Absolutely. And if you'll indulge me, I'm thinking of an example from my own farm. We just moved to a new location within the last year. And as we were doing an assessment of our infrastructure and going through the process of buying and moving into a new property, we have well water. And we thought, you know, okay, that's a pretty reliable source of water. But when we did a full assessment, we have one well for irrigation and for household use, and our septic tank was too close within the county and state codes to our wellhead to be considered safe. And now, when you're doing a hazard and risk, is the poop going to float back uphill 75 feet? Is an extra 25 to 50 feet away from the wellhead going to reduce the risk? I think it will. And it was interesting to go through that process with our county health department and recognize that even though we thought we had a pretty safe source of water, there were some hazards present because of the way that the system had been constructed. So within that, you know, we talked a little bit about the different sources of water. You have surface water, pond water. I have friends that have to irrigate from streams because their wells have run dry, or they don't have a current well, or they don't have the electricity at the site to pump. So are there any, you know, particular other concerns that we wanted to talk about in terms of water source? And do you have any examples of where growers have had to consider, you know, changing or supplementing their water because of, you know, contamination concerns?
All the time, Billy. Well, first off, my question to you about your well is, how deep's your well?
You know, that was one thing that we didn't get an answer on, and I'm interested in it from a food safety perspective. I'm also interested, you know, from a production and irrigation perspective. How deep is our well? How reliable is it? We did a flow test on it, and we did, you know, contamination of a battery of contamination tests. We have one additional layer on top of that. We are within the catchment area of the municipal water reservoir, so we have an additional layer of oversight and you know, inspection, ag production facilities within this, you know, area, get a checkup because we don't want to be contaminating, you know, a big reservoir.
Right. Makes good sense. But I mean, just like we talked about municipal water, have the reason municipal water is safer is because it's treated and because it's monitored. In the same respect, there's issues potentially around wells that go back to structural issues around the well. The depth of the well is a good example. The deeper the well, it tends to be safer than wells that are more shallow. You get a lot more surface water influence if that well is less than 30 feet. In some areas, it's pretty easy to hit water. You could drill down 5 feet and hit water. That water looks like well water, but it's actually surface water. It's basically surface water influenced, if nothing else. Even if it's not essentially surface water, it's definitely influenced by surface water. So recognizing the fact that there's nuances of safety within each of these categories is really important. So, yeah. I got lost. Where was the question?
We were just talking about the variety of sources of water. I think that's a perfect example where you might think that you have well water, but it's actually surface or surface influence. I've encountered growers that have had that issue. And it's a good reminder to me and hopefully to some of our listeners, if you don't know about what you have, it's a good first step to just do an assessment. And I want to go back and try to figure out how deep my well is. And there are, you know, issues. I know that the well was drilled in 1954. So are there any structural, you know, long-term issues there? As much information and knowledge as you can have about your setup, that gives you a good basis to, I think, analyze what your hazards and risks might be.
Right.
Speaking of which, you mentioned the tool that you worked on, MSU Cornell, University of Minnesota altogether. Can you talk a little bit more about that tool? I was really excited when I got to see it in person, and I think our listeners would really value learning a little bit about.
Sure. The tool itself, we've got a digital version and we've got a paper version. They are not necessarily equivalent. They sort of assess the same things and they walk people through the risks. And really the focus is, where's the poop? How much poop is there on the landscape or on the farm, and then how much risk is there of that poop moving into the water sources? It really looks at it, or it incorporates a lot of interdependent variables. Like, for instance, there may be poop on the landscape, but if there's no slope to the land and if there's no rain to move that poop into a water source, it's not getting there. I mean, people out west are a good example. When it doesn't rain for 9 to 10 months out of the year, there could be a ton of poop on the landscape, but it doesn't get in the water sources because there's no way to carry it into the water. So thinking more holistically about those interdependent variables with respect to water, like water wells, for instance, there's four basic ways that poop can get into the water source. You know, it can come in through cross connections, basically right down the pipe into it, and then there's also around the pipe. So because you basically got a straw right down to the water source. So if poop gets around the pipe, in like if there's no grouting or if there's bad grouting around a well, it basically can serve as a conduit down to pollute the water source. Then there's surface water intrusion. If it's a shallow well, surface water can get in there, and then poop and all of the contaminants that we associate with poop can also percolate down into the soil and slowly work their way into the well that way. So looking at all of those different variables, recognizing that the amount of poop on the landscape is important, really breaking those down and helping a grower think through, okay, so I have a lot of poop on the landscape, we get a lot of water, how does that affect what I'm doing? That's really what at least the RPT really helps to do. And in the digital version, at the end, you get a breakdown of each of the different risk factors, major risk factors, and what percent contribution to, you basically get a score, and then what percent of the contribution of each of these risk factors contributes to that score. So you can go through, look at your list of risks at the end and say, okay, I can reduce my number or reduce my risk by thinking in terms of, okay, I'll change this, and then that'll reduce my risk further. So it gives you sort of a check sheet of, I need to do this. Great example is wildlife. If you have or domesticated animals, if you have domesticated animals that can get into a well or around a well, that's going to be a higher risk and is going to kick a number up. So let me back up. The risk prioritization tool is a systematic way of helping to show you your risk in terms of a number, and the number is arbitrary. It's we would call it semi-quantitative. So with each risk or each bit of information you enter, we have worked with experts and looked at the literature to try and put together sort of the relative amount of risk contributed by each individual bit of information. So with that, each individual bit of information you get at the end, you get a score that's sort of based in science, but also based in professional judgment. So there is a fair bit of professional judgment built into this. And that score then at the end is broken down. What were the contributors to that score? And the highest percentage contributors, you can then, if you did something to mitigate those highest percentage contributors, it could bring down your score. So you have a roadmap to reduce the potential risk. The higher the score, the higher the risk. So reducing the number means reducing the risk. Does that help? I should have started with that. I should have led with that. But
no, that's a great place to land on. And I'm sure our capable host and producer, Catherine, will get a link to that in our show notes when we Absolutely. Put this episode out on the airwaves.
Most definitely.
Yeah, Phil, I got to see your tool back in March when I was at the North Central Regional meeting, and it was really timely that you guys were workshopping that right before the water rule came out, which, if you're plugged into food safety, you know, is a big part of FSMA that just dropped. So I'm wondering if you could talk about the new FSMA subpart E specifically, that Sure. rule, and how it's different from the previous one, and what are the most important things that growers should know about this?
Okay, so subpart E is the new FSMA water rule. One of the key things to realize is that water testing in the previous rule was the gold standard. You did an initial sort of like what they called a water system assessment. I'm trying to remember the name of it. Water system inspection, and it was meant to be a real general, real light. How much control do you have over your water source? How much, what is the water source? What is your degree of control? There were five major aspects of the ag water inspection, but it was very simplistic. And the idea was that if something changed on that list significantly, that was a signal to the grower that they really needed to pay attention to their water. It wasn't necessarily meant to be something that they do every time they irrigate, or even more than about once a year. It was meant to be something that's sort of like, okay, I'm kind of thinking through this. We've got no problem. We're good to go. The important part of the original subpart E was the water testing, and it set a threshold that growers had to stay under. When it came to this new rule, they de-emphasized water testing. They said, you can test your water, but you don't have to test your water. You will instead need to do something called an ag water assessment. The ag water assessment is sort of like a next level ag water system inspection, water system inspection. So it does look at the water system. It looks at all of the factors that were in that initial water system inspection, and it adds a whole lot more underneath it. The goal of this is to get growers to think about, okay, for the water sources that I'm using that come into contact with the harvestable portion of the crop or food contact surfaces, that water, where does the water, I mean, the first step is that water safe and of adequate sanitary quality? Or is it really assessing, they really want to know if it's not safe and not of adequate sanitary quality, then I need to stop using it altogether. Okay. And then I need to figure out from that how to get it back to safe, that is not unsafe and not of insanitary quality. So that language, unfortunately, is based on the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and it's problematic because we find ourselves often saying not of safe and adequate sanitary quality. So that's why I'm trying to be very careful and deliberate about how I'm speaking about it. So that first step is really, if the water is not safe and not of adequate sanitary quality, don't use it, and either find another source or get do some kind of corrective action or corrective measure to bring that back something closer to safe and of adequate standards.
I see. So with that in mind, like there being a new type of assessment, would you say subpart E looks at risk differently than previously?
Yes. Basically, the feds are saying you can't test your way out of doing an actual assessment. And so it's really built on stuff that was put out by the Leafy Greens Marketing Agreement and the idea of a risk assessment, and it's moving more towards what one would call a sanitary survey, which is what a lot of folks that do professional water assessments are going by. So.
And yeah, and would you say, I guess, what are some common questions you receive regarding water risk in general? And that might depend on, you know, this new subpart, but what are some questions you often get about risk?
The number one question, absolutely, is tell me what I got to do and I'll go do it.
Yep.
That is the number one question. Unfortunately, this rule defies that thinking, that kind of thinking. It's not a tell me what I got to do and I'll go do it. It's really trying to develop in growers a sense of looking at their water source, looking at the potential hazards. Can they get into my water source? What can I do about it? So that's why, you know, it's very different. We're going to have there's going to be a lot of education. There needs to be a lot of education for a grower to be able to do this in a way that makes sense. Does that help?
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for sharing.
So would you say that, you know, by using these tools for risk and hazard assessment and analysis, would you say that it has an added effect beyond food safety that affects operational effectiveness or efficiency? How would you quantify or in your experience, like how has that affected growers?
So I think the biggest thing is really for growers, the more they can not have agricultural water, the more they can limit the amount of agricultural water they use, the better. Reducing the number of sources that you use to contact not only the harvestable portion of the crop, but those food contact surfaces, and only selecting those sources that are high quality for that. In as much as is humanly possible, a lot of growers will choose a source based on proximity. And maybe the better way to do it is to think in terms of quality. So instead of choosing the river because it's close to my crop, or using rainwater because it's close to my crop, I'm going to use well water to do the crop sprays because that's my safest option. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, generally how, like if somebody identifies that they need to switch their water source, how difficult or easy is it usually to do that? I imagine it's different for all types of operations, but generally, like what would the methodology be to change your water source if you need to?
So part of this issue with these water system assessments or the ag water assessments is the number of sources you have, the greater the number of sources you have, the more essentially paperwork, the more work you're going to have to do. Yes, testing can help reduce your potential for problems. But ultimately, if you can reduce those numbers of sources, in some cases, it may be really easy. If I'm doing overhead irrigation on tomatoes, if I switch to drip irrigation on tomatoes, all of a sudden, I don't have to worry about the water quality of that irrigation water anymore. I'm more worried about just making sure I get enough water on there and maintaining my drip lines. So there's some value in not using overhead irrigation, for instance. In the case of like blueberries, for instance, you might have a blueberry field that's hooked up with both drip and overhead irrigation, overhead for frost control and drip irrigation. So they need to think about, okay, if I'm going to use my overhead irrigation during the season, and they may use it overhead during the season, I'm going to have to worry about the risk of that water source. Whereas if I just use the drip during the season, I'm not going to have to worry about it. It really requires them to think with every application, is the water going to get on the produce? Is there poop in that water? And how can I get in front of that poop? Does that help?
Yeah, I think so. Basically kind of streamlining the water that people have is making it easier paperwork-wise, as well as without the kind of cloudiness of, like, if there are contaminations, it makes it, I imagine, harder to identify which one it is because you have various water sources. Is that
yeah.
correct?
And from the standpoint of paperwork and doing ag water assessments, if you can say, I have one source that I use for crop sprays, and I use that same source for post-harvest water, and I use that same source for what little irrigation I do, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest where we get rain. Those situations, that's a way to really streamline your paperwork, reduce your exposure to the rule, and provide safer produce all at the same time. So in the same sense, I may have some really cruddy water that I know, so I can use that, apply that in a way that doesn't contact the harvestable portion of the crop, and then I don't have to worry necessarily about the quality of that water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, I wanted to chime in a bit on the same topic, just to give the example that, you know, there are a lot of intersectional ways that, you know, being a better water manager can support your operation. Talking about drip irrigation, I know that there are some USDA conservation programs that encourage transition to drip. And whether you're a farmer that's using surface water, or you're on a well, or you're pumping municipal, there is a fee, you know, for either running that pump, paying your municipality for your water, or, you know, out west, often water rights and the costs associated with water. So if you're using water more efficiently, that's saving you time, that's saving you money. There's a conservation and potentially even a climate impact. So you've got a lot of different positives towards transitioning to water usage that's also more food safe. So I think helping small growers understand all of those benefits together is a really great thing.
Cool. Yeah, I usually don't. I'm a hedgehog, unfortunately. I get really down deep into my little area, and I don't always think outside that. But you're right. Yeah, I mean, drip irrigation does save an awful lot of water, and it's a good way to be more efficient. Mm. And if there's a cost share program, it sounds like, Billy, you know of the cost share program. That might be another way to you know, tap in.
Yeah, we point folks to a bunch of different conservation and, you know, operational support resources and grants on the LFSC website, which we often include in the show note links as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, do you have any final advice any final advice to growers who are assessing risk? Maybe they're new to it, resources to refer to, etc. Just like, what are kind of some of your golden rules or just good philosophies that you would share with people?
So keep poop off food. Pay attention to where the poop is. Don't pick poopy mm-hmm. produce. Think about poop and be the poop, in the sense that, for lack of a better term, be the poop in terms of, like, okay, where am I? How am I getting on my produce, and what can I do to like really try and put yourself inside the bug's shoes, the bacteria shoes, and really think about how it can get there and then get in front of it. It's I think the Be the Bug, there was a very famous FDA captain. They called him Tommy Tomato, and he always talked about with respect to not inspection so much as investigations. Be the bug. Follow it. Follow back. Trace back where the bug would come from and how that bug got to the produce. So when farmers can be the bug or be the poop, they can follow that poop. And I think it's really important that they look for where those areas where poop can get in the system and then figure out ways of foiling the poop from getting in the system.
Yeah, it's interesting how much of the risk and hazard really revolves around poop and feces in I guess, the public health sphere as well, and just how that can really be a big disease vector.
For sure.
I wanted to highlight a point on that. That water safety is in the news this week. As we're recording this, the 2024 Olympics are going to start tomorrow.
Yeah, that's right.
And everyone is nervous about whether or not the levels of E. coli in the Seine River will allow for the swimming competitions. So water safety impacts our food safety, our sporting events, our entertainment.
Well,
it's not just this little food safety bubble that water quality is really important for.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking about that with my wife the other day, and it was kind of funny because we talked about it, and I said, you know, those standards, those E. coli standards, are based on about 4 ounces of water being ingested. You actually have to ingest the water, and there's a percentage of people that an acceptable number of people that can get sick. So, you know, there's going to be some people that drink that water that are going to be fine, and there are some people that are going to drink that water and not be fine. So it's only a percentage. So you're okay. You're no problem.
Take your chances, I guess, but be careful.
Right, roll the dice.
And we'll hopefully largely minimize the risk for society at large, ideally. I mean, that's why we have all these water treatment plants, and that's why there's so many professional people that work on this infrastructure. So, yeah.
Water's fascinating to me in the sense you can really go in a lot of different directions. And it's central to food safety because water's both that source of contamination and it's a route of contamination. So farmers really need to pay attention to it.
I have a question. This is something we were talking about as a team earlier this week. And, you know, any thoughts you have, like, please say, but I'm wondering if you have any opinions about how climate change affects water risk and, you know, the way we understand water rules when it comes to small ag, and just maybe some thoughts you've heard, maybe some resources. Yeah, anything related to climate change and water risk.
I definitely think it increases the potential for risk, or it increases the risk. Anytime things are getting warmer, and particularly, you know, at least in our area, the forecast is warmer and wetter. So we're going to have more water, bigger rain events, a lot more movement of poop in big boluses into surface water sources. And so that poop hangs around a whole lot longer and gets in water sources a whole lot faster and easier.
Right.
So from that standpoint, we need in the Midwest and the Northeast, even, you've got flooding issues. I was just talking to an onion grower this week who is dealing with flooding issues, and how do they figure out whether or not their onions are contaminated with something, and when do they know when to replant and all of these things. So flooding, more water, that's definitely going to be a problem. Faster movement of poop into water sources. A lot of municipalities have what's called a combined sewer overflow, which is a system where the sewer and the rainwater go through the same pipes. So what happens is that as long as there's not a lot of rainwater runoff, the sewer stays in the sewer. But as soon as there's a lot of water that enters the system. The sewage combines with the rainwater and gets discharged together. So all of a sudden now you have a situation where a municipality becomes a point source contamination to a surface water source. So there's a lot of issues there. And again, that's a climate change question, because we're going to have harder rains. The intervals of the rain, we're going to get more water in the same amount of time. So it's going to push more out. So yeah, climate change is a big issue.
Yeah, thanks for offering some perspective. I think it's something we all wonder about generally, like within food safety, but because water is one of those really, is a good conduit to carry lots of good and bad things through it. It's interesting to think about how climate change will affect that. So thanks for giving us some food for thought, or some water for thought, I guess.
Yeah.
There you go.
I'm glad you brought that up, Haley. It kind of reminds me, I read several years ago about how, yeah, a lot of the infrastructure for a lot of these, especially coastal cities like D.C., with the increase in storm water and like also the low, elevation of these places, it can kind of be a very chaotic future if we don't plan ahead for that. So hopefully we can do some mitigation planning and maybe also do some legislative. Of course, that's kind of beyond, well, actually it's not beyond food safety, because food safety is totally a part of all of that. Right. But I don't know. It's an interesting note to end on. But Haley or Billy, do you have any other final thoughts before we say goodbye?
I don't. Thank you. Thanks for answering and being here with us, Phil.
Well, thank you guys for the opportunity. I think there's real value in talking about what risks the things in water pose and how water carries those things onto crops. I think there's a real value in helping growers. It's going to take all of us. And the growers, we need to break it down so the growers can be receptive and break it down. Mm-hmm. It's not just growers that need to know about this. Inspectors are scared to death about this rule too. They don't know how to calibrate their expectations with the expectations of the growers and how to move that forward in a meaningful way. So it's going to require all of us to work together and all of us to talk about this and get everyone thinking about, okay, I'm using this water today from this source, and there's a potential that these things could be in this water. So the best way for me to use this water is X or Y. So.
Great. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us and shed some light on this subject. I know there's a lot of confusion and some stickiness around Subpart E and just generally with regarding water risk. So I think this will be really helpful. And we really look forward to sharing this. Thanks so much,
Thank
Phil.
Thank you. Take care now.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. The Local Food Safety Collaborative is a cooperative initiative established between the National Farmers Union Foundation and the FDA with the goal of providing training, education, and technical assistance to local food producers to ensure good food safety practices and compliance with the Food Safety Modernization Act. Find us on social media at Local Food Safety and let us know any questions, topics, or guests you'd like to hear from. National Farmers Union is a grassroots, farmer-driven organization that believes strong family agriculture is the basis for thriving communities. NFU's membership includes over 200,000 family farmers and ranchers across America. Farmers Union's grassroots structure promotes locally initiated policy priorities and educational topics established by their members. If you're interested in learning more about NFU and the work that we do, check out our website at www.nfu.org. Finally, this podcast is supported by the Food and Drug Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as a part of a financial assistance award 2U01FD006921-04 totaling $1 million with 100% funding by FDA-HHS. The contents are those of the authors and do not necessarily represent the official views of, nor an endorsement by FDA-HHS or the U.S. government. I'm Catherine Kavanaugh, and this has been the Food Safety Dish. Catch you next time.